Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a Lip Media podcast.
Sit, boo-boo, sit, boo-boo, sit.
Grr,
good dog.
That's some bad hat hair.
It's a cool
get any of that?
Not a doctor.
Bye, have a beautiful
formula.
Hello and welcome to Hunting Seasons, the podcast that dares to binge watch, deep dive, and break down a season of television each and every episode. I'm Broderick Gordis.
I'm Damask Leary.
And today we'll be discussing Fleabag Season 2. Damask Leary, how are you doing?
I'm quite well, thank you. It was my girlfriend's birthday yesterday.
Happy birthday, Angela.
That's right. Shout out to you. We went on a little getaway the last couple of days.
Ooh, nice.
And my butt really hurts.
From what?
I wish it was for sassy reasons, but it's not. It's because we went on like a 10K hike in the Yarra Valley, and I don't tend to use my body day to day.
Were you walking on your butt?
Yes.
You just bum
one
shuffled
10Ks. One cheek at a time,
Ks.
Buddy. One cheek at a time. That's my motto. How are you?
I can see why you don't walk often. You don't know how to.
They just don't make the right shoes for me to fit each cheek. Anyway, how are you?
Yeah, good. I'm kind of tired. I'm a bit tired this week.
What a great way to start the podcast.
No. Yeah. I was getting to a reason.
Okay,
there is a backstory.
All right.
I went to PAX. I know this is not a video game podcast, so I'll only talk about it briefly.
Good.
Went to PAX, Penny Arcade Nerd Expo in Melbourne. Yeah, Nerd Convention in Melbourne every year. Video games, board games and the such. It is exhausting. I was in line for 2 hours to play 10 minutes of video games that will be out inside 6 months.
The hellscape of your own making.
It
so
really
I have
is.
No sympathy
we,
for you.
I paid $150 to be there for 3 days to do it. It was actually a really good day, a really good weekend. It was nice to catch up with some friends and play some Vigi games and stuff like that, be around my people.
Cool.
I saw the Fleabag National, whatever it's called,
National
the theater
performance thingy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'll talk about it later in the podcast, but I did that on the weekend as well. So looking forward
That's
to
cute.
Discussing that a little bit as well. But we should get to our spoiler-free review of Fleabag Season 2.
Let me clue you in.
Season in review.
2.5 years after first airing, Fleabag returns for a second season, jumping back into the story 371 days, 19 hours and 26 minutes since we last saw our titular character. Season 2 is once again written by and stars Phoebe Waller-Bridge, with Harry Bradbeer picking up where he left off in the director's chair. The main cast of Season 1 also returns, alongside new inclusions Ray Fearon, Fiona Shaw, Angus Imrie, Kristen Scott Thomas, and most notably Andrew Scott as The Priest, or as the internet prefers to call him, Hot Priest. Season 2 consists of 6 episodes, each coming in at around 25 minutes, and took us approximately 2 hours and 30 minutes to watch. In 2019, Fleabag Season 2 was nominated for 6 Primetime Emmys. I think there's another 5 in the creative or arts or technical area as well.
Good lord.
Winning 4, including Outstanding Writing for a Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series, and Outstanding Comedy Series.
Mm.
As of recording this episode, there are no official plans for Fleabag to return for a third season. However, Waller-Bridge has just signed a substantial overall deal with Amazon Studios to produce new television content for Amazon Prime Video. So, first thing we should talk about, just let our listeners know what we thought of Season 1. We discussed in a podcast a couple of weeks ago. You can find that at huntingseasonspodcast.com. But yeah, what would you think of Season 1 of Fleabag, Damask?
I loved it. I loved it the first time I watched it, the second time, the third time, and each for different reasons. But I thought it was practically perfect in every way.
I similarly loved it. We both gave it 5 out of 5, a rare achievement on this podcast for any show. But yeah, very big fan of Season 1. So let's get talking about Season 2. Damask, can you give us your review of Fleabag Season 2?
I certainly can.
Oh, that's good to know.
Woohoo.
Thanks for that.
All right. I have watched this season 3 times now, and the first viewing left me cold while I was reading.
Whoa. Really, we're starting there. Holy shit, that's a revelation.
Well, this is my spoiler-free review. Got to be honest about these
things.
I like it.
I'm shocked, but I like it. Go on.
Now, while I was reading rave reviews and fresh takes on Twitter about how it was just as good as the first season, I didn't feel that way. Season one was so goddamn great, and season two was good. But I laughed less, and I found the central story less engaging. I didn't connect or sympathize with the story like I had with the first. Then I watched it a second time and a third time. It's a love story after all, and I wanted to feel the love. This season, we see false intimacy colliding with the real thing, and our protagonist tries to figure out what the hell that all means. Unhealthy desires fuse with healthy ones to create confusion, excitement, and fear. Our Fleabag meets someone that might lead her down a very different path. The back and forth, the struggle taking place between our girl and her love interest, it's a dance. Each one wanting to entice the other into their own way of life. But their genuine care for one another keeps them each safely and respectfully in their own lane. And the tension, ooh, the tension. This season, we also get a closer look at Fleabag's family. The character of Claire is still as watchable this time around, playing the ultimate likable shrew. She has to come to terms with the choices she made last season, and whether the role she has played all of her life really fits anymore. And the more we see of Fleabag's family, the more we realise that there is a place for her to fall. It isn't perfect, and those around her will rarely say or do the right thing, but there is love there. Now, so there's lots of good stuff in this season, obviously, but I prefer the first season. It was a special show that reached into my heart and told me a story about a deplorable woman who is, in fact, despite her inability to see it, incredibly lovable. The first season is when Fleabag is at her lowest, and for that, it's special. We see her exploring the abyss and all of its darkness. It's scary, but it's brave. This season has Fleabag standing on the edge between the light and the dark, waiting for her eyes to adjust. It's interesting, enjoyable, humorous, and clever, but it didn't stay with me the way season one did. It's a valid continuation and of a spectacularly high standard because, duh, I recommend you all go out and watch it, but I will say this. If life is about choosing the right place to put love, I choose season one.
Beautifully said.
Thank you.
Beautifully said. What? I completely disagree. No, I don't completely disagree. I think that's a very fair place to... to sort of hang your hat on this.
Yeah.
I definitely understand why you prefer season one. I, however, prefer season two.
I'm sure you do.
Oh, really? Wow. I'm detecting some judgment there.
No, go on.
So, first of all, one thing I just like about the show is it starts with a bit of a time jump. It takes place a year later. I think it could have been very easy to start from just sort of where we left off at the end of season one. Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting move to go so far into the future and jump in there. There's a lot that we sort of miss that I think other shows might have chosen to do whole seasons about. But there's a little more mystery and excitement to just jumping ahead through some of that and going, well, this is a new entry point, and there's a reason that we've been allowed back into Fleabag's life here, and I want to talk about that when we get to our spoiler-free review as well. And there are certain elements of season one that just get dropped entirely. I don't think this is a spoiler to say, but the cafe, her business that she runs, is a very important part of season one. Virtually non-existent this season. Not the cafe isn't there, but it's not a big part of the overall drama in any way. And it's like it just knew that that was season one stuff. We're doing season two stuff. This is a different story, a different time of this character's life. I really appreciate that. It's really hard to understate how important the chemistry between Fleabag and Hot Priest, I will talk to him, call him Hot Priest throughout this.
God, all right.
The priest?
I call him, priest.
No, Hot Priest, definitely Hot Priest.
All right.
It is hard to deny their chemistry, and I think it is the bedrock of this season has to be you have to believe that these two people could be so attracted to each other that they would be... especially the priest, Hot Priest, be willing to play with the idea of changing their lifestyle so much. That makes sense. And I think their chemistry is fucking sizzling. Like, it is really, really fun to watch. And in a lot of ways, one of the reasons I love season two as much as I do and do prefer it that little bit more on season one is I find it exhilarating from start to finish. There is an excitement level to it because Fleabag is excited. And in season one... again, let's not talk spoilers here, but there were things that got her excited, but nothing that sort of reached into her soul like...
Well, she wasn't at that stage.
No, she wasn't. Yeah. And it's just a different story, absolutely. Yeah. But it is really fun to see this character in such a different place. Mm-hmm. It's exciting and new for her in a lot of ways. And I felt that as a audience member. Mm. I really, really loved it. I also have to disagree with you about the whole laughing less thing. I think I laughed more.
Really?
Yeah, I really do. I think wow. I was laughing more through this season. I thought it was funnier overall. There is a... The first episode of this season alone is just hysterical. I really, really love a lot of what's going on here. And I don't want to give away any particular jokes, but yes, I found this season funnier. Something I just wanted to bring up too that we hadn't brought up previously. I just wanted your opinion on it. What did you think of the soundtrack that goes under this season? It's a little bit different. There's this sort of big choir. It's not there all the time, but often there's like this, almost like this angelic choir of doom behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Did you enjoy that? Did you have any particular thoughts about that or feelings on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it helped express the magnitude of the situation.
Totally, and fits with the themes of religion and stuff, obviously, as well. Did you know, I didn't know this until recently, that Isabel Waller-Bridge, Phoebe's sister, composed the music for both series.
That's wonderful.
There you go. Good. I just bring that up as well. And also, I just wanted to talk about how this works as a conclusion. There is no plans for a season 3 at this stage. Phoebe Waller-Bridge hasn't completely taken the idea of a season 3 at some stage in the future off the table.
Mm-hmm.
But if this is the ending, I think it really, really works at the ending. I also think it works fantastically as a middle chapter.
Mm.
I could very easily see there being a third season for a number of reasons.
Agreed.
One thing I did want to ask while we're still in the spoiler-free part, what do you think of shows like this... This show in particular, obviously, but other shows like this with seasons that are so short. Last off-topic, hot topic, we talked about how series or shows not going on for too long can be a good thing.
Mm.
But what about shows like this where they're like 25-minute episodes, six each? It's essentially a 2.5-hour movie.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work for a TV show for you? Is it worthy of being a TV show? Is it really just an extended movie cut into parts? Like, do you feel about it any differently?
No, it's certainly a TV show because it is episodic.
Yes, go on.
Yeah. I don't care how long or short a show or a season is as long as it's good television and well told.
It's actually something I was going to say. This season feels more like a movie to me.
Than last season. Yeah,
last season feels more episodic. Episodes were more... They don't have episode titles, but I was able to define that as that's the Harry episode. That's the Martin episode or whatnot, right?
Mm.
This season was like, you could put the middle chapters in particular from like 2 to 5 together and like that could just be one extended episode. They're not as well defined. It is kind of just like one big movie that's been cut up into parts in a lot of ways. But I just wanted to bring that up as just an interesting...
But yeah, that also plays with like our expectations of rhythm of story. If the expectation is a movie...
Yeah, sure.
I think then, like, it's certain you'd want to reach certain points here and there. Whereas I haven't seen it cut together, and expecting it to be a movie, whether the experience would be the same.
It's just interesting, also, because every time I've watched this, I've watched it all in one go. Like, I've never watched like one episode a day or even two episodes at a time.
Yeah,
I watch them all.
Yeah,
they all get. I
understand like all together, but like in watching an episode, you expect like an arc. Yeah, yeah.
But even just in the sense of like, yes, you could cut it differently. But it's consumed basically like a movie. By the time I'm done with it, it was basically a 3-hour movie I just watched, or 2.5-hour movie. Anyway, final score and ranking, Damask.
I'm gonna give it a 4, which so after
4, it's a whole star step down. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And obviously, this ranks second to the first season.
Yes.
Cool.
It's just not as funny or as poignant for me.
Sure. I'm going to score it a 5.5. I can't do that.
You can't do that.
I was like, how do I score more than a 5? It is impossible. So I have to give it a 5 as well, which is 2 5s. And for me, this is marginally my preferred season. Maybe better isn't the right word.
It's the one you like.
But it's the one I enjoy more. More excited by, enjoying more as I went along with it.
Mm-hmm.
That it's just a great season of television.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Before we dive into spoilers, we'd like to remind everyone that if you enjoy what we do here, we'd really appreciate you sharing the podcast with others who you think might also enjoy listening. We also appreciate your positive reviews on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. But right now, let's talk spoilers.
You're now entering the spoiler zone.
Spoiler warning. On this episode, we'll be discussing everything that happens in Season 1 and 2 of Fleabag. Before listening any further, we recommend watching all of Fleabag up to this point. If you've not yet done so, proceed with caution. There are spoilers ahead.
You have been warned.
Deep dive.
It's cool to know other people think about this stuff too.
Something I want to start with for our deep dive is just to go a little bit further into the nature of Fleabag's fourth wall breaking.
Yeah.
Because I find it interesting, like, how it is such a structure of the show existing, right? We enter or we leave season one with her sort of, she stops addressing the camera. She's like ashamed of that we found out or that everyone's talking about the whole boo thing and she just stops. She just can't look at us anymore, basically. Mm-hmm. And then this season starts with her in the bathroom and we have that whole moment of like her wiping the blood off her face and then she turns to the camera and goes, this is a love story. And it's like, we're back. She's like re-engaged with the audience. So the first question there, I guess, is that what happened there basically? Is this like her getting to a point where she's like, something's happened. I need that crutch back. Is that what that's suggesting, do you think? Or has she been talking to the audience again from earlier on, do you think? Like, what's the...
Yeah, I don't know. I guess my feeling was at the end of season one, the reason that she could no longer, like, continue to disassociate and talk to us was because she was forced into being present.
Yep.
Whereas all of season one, she kind of, like, was allowed to be wrapped up in her own bullshit. And sure. So in the closing moments of season one, that's why she stopped. Yeah, I don't have the answer for you as to whether she hadn't spoken to the audience at all until that moment.
That's the feeling I get. And there's a bit, she has this little expression on her face because she sort of pauses for a moment before she starts. That's almost like I shouldn't do this, but I'm going to do it. And then she turns and like starts it. And then there's a question for me, particularly in the first episode, of how performative the rest of that episode is. Because if that is the moment where she decides to look at the camera or talk to the camera again, right? It means the rest of the episode is her, it's like a flashback. She is retroactively inserting her talks to camera in after the fact because she didn't start beforehand. So there's a certain performance to what she's doing because she's already experienced it once. And we know that she can do this because she does it in flashbacks in season one. She will have a memory back to when that guy's fucking her saying, "You're so young, you're so young." And like, and like she will talk, flashback, or sorry, talk to the audience.
Talk to us in the present,
yes.
From the past.
Yes, yeah, correct. And so we know she can do that. And so that basically, that whole episode, anytime she's talking to the camera while she's at the dinner table, was retroactively or retrospectively.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's something just interesting about the mechanics of that and what that means and how performative it is and why she chose now to re-engage with the audience and why this is the start of season two or chapter two in Fleabag's
story. So why do you think she started again?
It comes down to that it's exactly as she said, this is a love story, right? So it's like she's spent a year away from Claire. She's been like getting herself better. You know, the cafe is going well. She's been clean eating and all this sort of stuff, self-improvement. But this is another internal crisis of a completely different sort. And like, there's a couple of things going here. A, she's re-engaged to a relationship with Claire at that point, which is a big deal because that was the last saw Claire was when the last time we saw them together.
Really her only other relationship outside of Boo that she has.
Totally. Yeah. And then this is the first person. This is the next person. One of the things we're going to talk to about is this idea of where does Fleabag put her love, right? This love she had for her mother. She originally gave it to Boo after her mother died. And now this might be the next person. And so it's a important big moment and she needs, or she feels she needs that crutch. And there's a discussion with the therapist that I wanted to get to as well, in which we talk about the fact that she... Well, it's just that it sort of leads into it, I think. We talk a lot about sex and about the girl with no friends and the empty heart.
Yeah.
And the point that's made in that is that this is a diagnosis that the therapist is making, that Fleabag is making.
Yeah.
And we get to the point where she kind of suggests that her only friends are us, which how real are we? Are we real? Are we friends? Is this all just an internal monologue? Is she just talking to herself the entire time? Like, is that a realistic thing to say, or is that, I just find the whole concept, it's on a meta level, very, very interesting because it can be a literal just, she's talking to herself and we're just, this is a TV show and we understand that, or meta, physically, there is something going on here. I just think it's all very interesting. Sorry, I jumped around a bit there.
A lot of
big ideas.
All right, well, going back to the first point about why, I guess, she starts disassociating again. I think that's really interesting. And there's, I guess, a few possibilities as to why that might be occurring. Because she has that conversation with her dad and he's like, you know, you're not being naughty. And she's like, well, it doesn't matter, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
And then, so I guess like there's almost this sense that she's kind of been very numb or kind of, you know, is on the level for a bit. And the highs and lows that she has gone through her entire life aren't there anymore. So I guess she is maybe perhaps been blocking that side of her out, and that includes her relationship with us, the audience. And then there's someone there that, could that be a possible high on its way? This is then like, oh, okay, this is exciting. And just falling back into that same pattern of when things are really, really great or really, really bad, she's able to disassociates during moments and is totally wrapped up in the emotions of them, whether they're good or bad. So it starts again. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting.
That moment she has with her dad outside, the whole like, it doesn't matter. I read that incorrectly, I think, the first time. At first, I thought she was just blowing him off. It's like, it doesn't matter. Like,
yeah,
it's like, it's nothing, don't worry. But I think your reading is right. It's like this whole idea, it's meaningless. You know, it doesn't matter is correct.
Like, who's she being naughty for, kind of thing. Like, well, yeah, she can't go and tell Boo. She's not talking to us anymore. It doesn't really matter. I don't really have a need to do. But yeah, I guess like if you're naughty, you can't share it. You don't have any joy in it, so you don't feel the high that you may have in the past doing those types of things.
This like highs and lows that you're talking about in her life, these exciting moments that maybe is when she disassociates and when she interacts with the camera, skipping right to the end for a second, just for the dad. We've mentioned the dad. There's conversations sort of bookend this series. The second one being, well, there's the flashback in the middle when they're at the mother's funeral. But at the very end, he says to her, I think you know, or you know how to love better than any of us. Which is why it's so hard for you. And do you think that's part of what this is? Is that just she is just emotionally maybe more raw or on a different level or spectrum than the others in her life?
I think, yeah, it's obviously so much fear there. And I think, you know, rightfully so, he's gone through a lot of heartache. But, yeah, she's probably just an incredibly sensitive person that, and I guess like her, the fact that she sees things that other people don't see and that's how she connects with the audience, I think that shows that she, yeah, is astute and perceptive and all of those things and can read people pretty well. And so is obviously like quite emotionally intelligent, if not so slightly emotionally negligent.
What would you like to talk about, Damask? What's on the cards?
Okay, so my main issue with this season that really kept me at arm's length was the priest thing.
Okay, let's go. I mean, it is the center, the central point of this entire season. What about that?
I have a real issue with the fact that he's a priest.
Okay, go on.
And I know it's not the experience of most people, but yeah, it's very hard for me as a recovering Christian to see someone who is in a position of power in a church behave so inappropriately. Like, and I've kind of thought about it more and more the more times I've watched the season, being like, well, he's a person. Just because someone lives within the church, I think it's really important for them to have human connections and not be this other being kind of thing.
Sure.
Is it so terrible for them to have romantic relationships, not sexual relationships? Because if you've taken a vow of celibacy, then you should stick with that, though I don't agree with vows of celibacy.
Sure.
What would be, what's so bad about romantic relationships? But it really just comes down to the fact that I just have a huge sign in my brain that just no, like I don't find it sexy. I don't find it hot. I have real issues with it. And I think it's just, a familial cultural type thing that is hard for me to get over. Yeah.
Fair enough. Can we unpack it a little bit though? Because I think the important word there was power, right? He's in a position of power.
Not to me. That's not the key word. I mean, because I don't think he has power over her because she's not a part
absolutely.
Of the church.
Yeah.
But I think there like are moral standards, codes of conduct that he has sworn himself to. And it's just like just watching this person make these terrible decisions just stresses me the fuck out. And I just think they're wrong.
So, but this is really interesting.
And I know I shouldn't, but it's just like it really, and I have tried so hard to fight, and I think I was quite successful last viewing in doing that and really seeing him as a human.
Yep.
And that the whole priest thing is really just kind of like an allegory or a metaphor for any person that is not in the position to love you how you want them to love you, whether they're married or whatever it might be.
Ultimately,
like,
yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's what it is, and they can tell that story without you being like, oh, that's really fucked up because there's a poor wife who's being hurt.
Yeah.
So you can tell that story in a much more balanced way, which is really cool.
Yep.
But it's just the imagery of the thing that is, yeah, a real roadblock for me.
So because I think it, okay, yeah, I think it, the imagery totally makes sense to me. Like, if you just look at the situation of a Catholic priest, you know, and the church, and obviously there's a lot of bad stuff associated with that. As a recovering Christian yourself, and you think about what's been happening in Australia and the rest of the world, Cardinal Pell, etc., right?
Mm.
Lots going on there. But I guess for me, I think the thing that's interesting, you're talking about how you're making him make bad decisions, right? And that sort of is like problematic for you or distressing for you. It just speaks to me to one of the things I want to say, which is honest, in a lot of ways, Hot Priest, this could have been his show. It could have been its own show. We are watching this through Fleabag's perspective because this is Fleabag, right? Mm-hmm. And it's great. There's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. But I find what the priest is going through, his own struggles, so compelling on their own. Or if you were just to flip the perspective and make it his, it would be just as interesting to me. Because I think what you're saying, I think what he's going through this season is kind of what she was doing in season one. Like, she's making bad choice after bad choice after bad choice. And you found that exhilarating. You found that fascinating. And like, yeah, it's distressing and hard and awful at times. But you found that compelling. And I think that's true for the Hot Priest for me. Because, yeah, you're right. He's making terrible decisions, especially for himself. And it takes him a long time to get to a place where he makes the quote-unquote right choice, probably. But I wonder how much you're missing out on there just because of the imagery of it, unfortunately.
It's a real shame because I think there's a lot there. I fully admit that I think, like, the idea of, like, oh, that's really interesting. And everything you are saying, I agree with. I'm like, absolutely, I agree with that. I just really can't get past it. It's a real shame, isn't it? But it's – and, yeah, so I tried to remove that emotion out of my third viewing. And so I found their relationship a lot more endearing and beautiful and complex and all of these things the third time round, which was good. But it's never going to be great to me because I don't feel the natural exhilaration.
You seem to reflexively keep him at a distance.
Yeah,
you have to. It's like a shield you're putting up, protective mechanism. that makes sense. That was my next question, really, was, you know, Hot Priest, right?
Am I right?
Was the meme, you know? That was of all the things that were talked about around this, it was Hot Priest. And, I wanted to ask, did you find him attractive? Did you find their relationship, did you feel that chemistry on any level?
Yeah, no, the first time I watched it, I found his whole, like, oh, I'm so uncool and, like, bleh, I was like, fuck off, mate. Like, I just thought that was a bit much, to be honest with you. He's like, oh, I'm a relatable priest. I say fuck. Whoa. that was a bit much, the first viewing. To the point that I was like, is he going to end up being a bad guy? Because they clearly try to make him very relatable and likable. Wasn't the case. But further on as the relationship grows, there is obviously genuine chemistry and like care. And that guy, I think, is a phenomenal actor. He's really good.
You could argue he is a bad guy. I mean, I think there's an argument that what Hot Priest does in this season is very irresponsible and that he was never really going to be with her and that he just indulges his urges for a moment and throws her under the bus at the end. I think almost literally because they end up at a bus stop. But the line for me, there's a line that I keep coming back to just in terms of like its intention and how it's written.
Okay, yeah.
That's really interesting. It's got to do with the last scene they have together where she says, I love you, and he says, it'll pass.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Which is probably correct and matter of fact, but feels really emotionally kind of rough in that moment. It's kind of cold.
I didn't read it like that.
Only because I feel like he's the one moving on. It's easy to say like, oh, you'll be fine because I'm the one who's made the decision. I'm not saying it should be read like that.
No.
But I think you could. And if you want to argue that like, if you wanted to argue that maybe he's a bit of a villain, maybe he is. Maybe he's a little bit of a bad guy.
I don't think he is.
He's...
I mean, they're as bad as each other.
That is the truth of it,
that line, you know, it'll pass. It's so full of sadness that it's...
True.
Yeah, he's so upset for her and himself.
They have a lot of good conversations throughout the series, often about sex, about his history with sex. He's been there many times before. Sex won't bring anything good. Certainly conclusion that,
bothers me. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because it's reflective of season one. Why does that bother you, that conversation?
It's just a purely human reaction because I know what they're doing because we've all done it before. Well, you talk about the thing so much in a way that you're like, well, that thing is definitely not going to happen. So let's just talk about how much it's not going to happen. All in an effort to definitely make sure that you both know that it's going to happen. It's just like, and it's like the therapy says, you already know what you're going to do.
Yes.
That's why it always keeps coming up over and over again because they've both made the choice.
And again, you want to argue that he's the bad guy? He knew he was going to fuck her and then go back to God. Like he did. He did. It was inevitable that that was going to happen. He'd already made that choice. So are you saying that that conversation is distressing because it's obvious or because it's like you feel this?
No, because I feel it because I'm a human and I'm like, stop it. I just want to walk in there and just like pat them both on the nose and say, no, no. That's what I want to do.
Roll up newspaper.
That's right.
A moment we have to get to, though, and when I talk about this season being exhilarating, and just before talking about the mechanics of the fourth wall breaking, the incredible moment.
I'm really scared.
No, it's later in that conversation where she looks to the camera and says something and he goes, where'd you go?
That is really fun. You're like, what?
Yeah, right?
What a twist. Yeah.
Because, it's just like the part of my brain is just like the metaphysical implications of this. Mm. But on another level, it's just their chemistry is already kind of undeniable. And to have this guy sort of see something that nobody else sees, a secret that only we've been privy to, is fucking amazing. And then, like, the next episode when they're talking in the cafe and he just goes that there and like looks directly into the camera for just a second.
Yeah.
It is fucking exciting and like scary. It's really interesting.
Yeah. I obviously the first time when I watched that, when he first turned, you're like, whoa, what's going on? And then the cafe, when he does the full on turn around and screams into the camera, you're like, what's happening? It was really exciting. But no, I love this idea of her kind of the false intimacy that she's built with us. Like that's kind of her sharing place. And because they share real intimacy, he just sees right through it and kind of begins to replace us in that way, which is really cool. But no, it's certainly an exciting development.
To the point where she even gets mixed up a couple of times.
Yeah, like, about his neck.
Yeah.
He's got such a beautiful neck.
Says the wrong thing. It's like, it's not just distraction. It's like, yeah, she is sort of mixing the two. She is opened herself up to this guy and they get the two intertwined. I also think that comes with a real vulnerability that she expresses really well when she sort of tells him to leave. When he starts to ask questions that like really starts to press her about, you know, where she's going and I think the boo of it all and stuff like that. And then she's like, I need you to go now. And she kind of gets quite upset at him.
He says that he's there to like help her or whatever.
Right.
She's like, well, that's not what I wanted.
And I think that's really true too. That felt really real when you get to a point with someone that you are starting to get vulnerable. It gets kind of scary and you will push them away a bit.
Oh, bro. I'm a lesbian. We don't push them back. Like, let me tell you everything right now. We'll talk all night. We'll be married by the morning.
But like that vulnerability can become anger in a sense for a bit. It's like a protective mechanism, but okay, sure. Okay. our lived experiences are slightly different. That's fine. Another thing I do like about La Hot Priest though, and I did already sort of suggest this, is that there's a story going on there that we only are seeing from the outside. When she goes to the church at night before they have the big confession scene. Right before that, he turns the music on and she goes and finds him in his little priest quarters at the back, which are very true to life, by the way. Someone who spent some time in those sorts of areas, because my grandfather was a priest, I performed in churches and stuff like that with plays and stuff. That's exactly what they look like and feel like. They're a weird space. But like he is in a bad way.
He has a drinking problem.
Yes, he does. And he is suffering at that point. He is internal turmoil. He is really questioning the thing that he thought was the bedrock of his life with his faith and his priestdom and about his feelings towards Fleabag. Mm. It's very compelling, I thought.
Yeah, the little hints we get of his life are very interesting. So, because both of his parents are alcoholics.
Mm-hmm.
His brother is a pedophile. Guy's probably had a pretty rough fucking life.
Yep.
Yeah, and he clearly has a drinking problem. Even the fact that he knows that this woman is a person that he's interested in,
mm-hmm.
and is continuously trying to get drunk with her.
Yes. And it's this, like, if alcohol is a temptation of its own, she is another one. Mm-hmm. He's finding himself coming up weak over and over and over again, it seems like. I think that he toasts his to peace and those who get in the way of it. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what she's doing. She's fucking with his peace. When is it worse, do you think, that your love interest chooses someone who you don't even believe is real over you? Like, it's one thing that if he just had a wife, right, which is a metaphor for. Mm. Well, not a metaphor, maybe, but like a simile for, in a way, that this could have just been he was with another woman and he was getting bored with that relationship and starts to fuck around with Fleabag and then now I got to dedicate myself back
it's
to my wife.
It's way better for someone to choose God,
is it?
The creator of all, that they truly believe is real,
sure.
than just another woman or person. Of course it's better that they choose God.
But I just think that's interesting. That's like, it's someone that you don't believe in. It may even think is a delusion, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, that someone would choose something that you don't think even exists or is real,
well,
over you. That's going to bruise your ego a bit.
It's not that much of a foreign thought for me because my parents are Christians.
Sure.
And they believe being gay is a sin.
Sure.
So if you want to talk about that, I kind of know what that feels like. So
it's up to you whether you want to talk about that or not on the podcast. That's
so. That's real. But if my parents said we think being gay is a sin because Gary down the street said it, I'd be upset. I'd be far more upset. But they're like,
who the
God-
fuck is Gary?
Exactly. but God, the creator of all, the savior of their souls, says it. That's a little easier to take. I do have a question for you, though.
Yes.
Now, you say that your grandpa was a priest.
Yes.
Was he hot?
Well, I mean, he's part of my gene pool, so obviously.
Woohoo, yeah.
there's a couple little moments here as well that are just interesting in terms of Fleabag and the camera. She pushes us away mm-hmm. when she's having sex with a hot priest. And then the ending, and maybe we're not at the ending yet. Maybe we should talk about Claire. We spent a year without Claire. That's pretty big information that
mm-hmm.
after that we established such a connection together. And there, the end of season one was very traumatic, obviously, for Fleabag.
Mm-hmm.
The idea they didn't see each other for a year. And you said, I think, at the end of our review of season one that you felt so strongly against Claire's decision
Yeah.
Like, it hit
really
you pretty
upsetting.
Hard that she
yeah.
did that. So, how do you feel that within basically an episode, it's not all fixed, but they're back, like, rooting for each other or in each other's corners again? They're supporting each other again?
Yeah, I think firstly, this season really cements the fact that Claire, and I kind of knew this in season one, but it really cements it in season two, is that Claire doesn't believe Martin's story of what happened.
No.
She just has to believe it because otherwise her marriage is over.
Yeah.
And she's not ready for that yet. So when she's in...
She's not ready to confront herself for who she truly is and make herself happy, the quote she was making.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So this time around, she's being forced to see Fleabag again.
Mm-hmm.
And it may have gone the way of, we have quiet dinner, go off into the night and the relationship continues to be fractured.
Yeah.
It just so happens that that's the night she has miscarriage.
Yeah.
And so they share something and are reminded of their sisterly bond.
That's quite a scene.
Ooh, get away from my miscarriage.
Yeah.
Oh, will that break your heart? Fucking hell. It's both funny and makes you go, oh God, my heart.
And also she didn't. Like she managed to.
She's like, oh, it's no, it's
right
mine
in.
Now.
Her
it's
mine now. She literally took it for herself.
Oh, and then Martin, the fucking dickwad.
He is quite the cunt. And into a step above.
My term of, I use dickwad because I was like, we've got more international listeners, should I say cunt. But apparently it's cool. We're still doing it.
Honestly,
sweet.
I don't know. Do you have a better word?
No, I think it's aptly describes
the
Martin.
Appropriate word? Okay, yeah. Good to know. I need your permission on that one. Thank you. The He is worse this season than he was last season, even. He is...
Oh, he's disgusting and... Oh, it makes my skin crawl.
When he is at the bar after he's had a drink, obviously, even though he's telling Claire he wasn't, and says to her, to Fleabag, you know, how are you going to make this about yourself tonight? And then all this stuff's happening with Claire at the table. She just had the miscarriage. She sat down instead of leaving, which was the plan. That's distressing and exhilarating. Again, very, very sort of like a lot of tension there that's pretty incredible, I think, as a viewer.
Oh, yes.
But...
great just eye work between both those women at the table. The eye acting was phenomenal.
But even just like it just seems so unfair on Fleabag, right? She's not talking. She's not making it about herself. And Claire's like, why aren't you talking? And somehow not talking is making the focus her. And then when she is just trying to step in for Claire, oh, here come the eye rolls from Martin. Here we go. Blah, blah, blah. And then that moment when he talks
like
about how the
fish out of a
fucking water
bowl. Whatever. Oh, my God. Like a fish out of a bowl. Oh, my God. Just like, and okay. So I do love the scene when he's like talking to Fleabag and he's really upset, obviously, because he's kind of figuring out that Claire's leaving. And he just screams like, I was trying to make her feel better. Just while you feel for him in that moment because he's so pathetic and he's so scared and so upset, the acting in that scene is phenomenal. It's so good. That guy's amazing. You also say, like, for fuck's sake, Martin, that's not how you make someone feel better. It's by insinuating that their sister, who has apparently just had a miscarriage, oh, the fetus was purposely trying to leave her body because it would rather be dead. Oh, my God. It's just, he's the worst. He's forever the worst.
What's his excuse? I'm not a bad guy. I just have a bad personality. It's not my fault.
Which is very good. It's wonderfully written. He gets so many amazing lines.
He does. I do really cherish the moment in episode 6, though, where Claire gets to throw back his line about the fishbowl back at him, though.
Yeah. It's
like,
good.
Just, oh, it was my miscarriage. And then, like, we were pregnant. It's like, oh. You know, and it just throws that awful line back at him.
And
it's so satisfying.
I love it because Godmother earlier said to Fleabag, she's like, please don't have another miscarriage, as in like, don't make another scene. And then Claire, finally, she gets to make her scene and it's beautiful.
How do you feel about like Claire without Fleabag, I guess. If Claire has been, or Fleabag's been away from Claire for a year, season one establishes that in a lot of ways, Claire feels very responsible for Fleabag and for Martin and for their son, whose name I've forgotten all of a sudden.
Creeper,
yeah. Yes. Jake, I think. And by all intents and purposes, Fleabag is doing okay at this stage, right? She's looking after herself. The cafe is going great. She hasn't needed Claire, really. If anything, Claire has needed her more in this season at least. And so this sort of changing world for Claire, who is Claire when she's not needed, I guess, when she doesn't need to look after a broken sister and stuff.
Yeah. I think that's the thing, is that Claire characterizes herself as this woman who is put upon.
Yes.
And so, you know, I guess even like trying to save her marriage with Martin and saying goodbye to Fleabag, you know, she's put upon, she's got all these responsibilities. And I think, yeah, being pregnant, you made her go, oh, this is going to be it forever. I will always be the woman who was just put upon. Fuck, that's, oh, God, this will be forever for the rest of my life. And then she has a thought, I don't want my husband's baby.
Yeah.
And so she doesn't want to be put upon person anymore. And so she's able to shift her relationship with Fleabag. She stops taking that role. Instead of, you know, Fleabag tells her about the priest, instead of being like, oh, fuck, oh no, how do I fix it? She laughs and says, you're my hero, because she doesn't want to play that role. And she starts to take the steps to do that, which is awesome.
I do love the moment where Fleabag's talking about like chasing Claire.
The airport, when she's talking about the airport.
The only person I'd run through an airport for is you.
That's beautiful.
That is one of the most, without having to do a stupid run through an airport, of which Glow did recently, kind of. and was like, why are we doing this? And it was obviously a cliche. It was not the same context. But
Claire's little monologue about why that would be so fucking weird.
Oh, totally.
Is so funny.
Yes.
And she's like, what? I just run into him at CVS while he's buying socks. I'm like, oh, hey, I happen to know your flight number. What gate it was at? Like, she's like, that would be fucking insane. And it would be.
But the sentiment at the end. She would do that for Fleabag. It's the closest. You know, it's a pretty amazing expression of love for your sister, I think, and why I love them as a pair.
Yeah.
Oh, they're so great
and
together.
Also, like, it says so beautifully, like, well, yes, they think one another is insane. They never truly believe that one another is insane. Like,
yes,
you're crazy and I love you, but I know you're not crazy.
Yeah, 100%.
Because I know who you are, which is beautiful. Yeah,
I know you better than anybody else and you know me. And yeah, there's something really, really beautiful about that.
Yeah.
Let's go back to Fleabag for a second.
Mm-hmm.
There's an interesting scene actually in the episode where Fleabag's helping Claire out with the function she's got on, which is quite a fun episode. Lots of Claire and Fleabag together, which is always good.
Yeah.
I do like the moment where Claire gets angry at her because she put a joke in her head that she ended up using. And then she's...
I don't need your jokes.
And she's talking about... Claire's talking about... It's a quote. I can't remember it exactly. It's this quote, this idea that she's worried that she's a failure or something. And then I love just the cut to the wide of like... don't talk about this office. But no, in that episode, great. I really wanted to talk about the conversation that Fleabag has with Belinda.
Ugh.
Maybe you should talk about this. I feel like you've got some thoughts on this conversation.
Oh, not anything about the conversation, just the chemistry.
Oh, yeah.
The sensuality of it, the sexual chemistry of it.
Well, it's interesting. There's a big conversation about menopause in there. Not the sexiest conversation in the world, but an interesting perspective.
Depends who's talking about menopause, obviously, which I think this scene proves.
Just this idea that gets better for women, this expression of like how when you're a fertile young woman, essentially, there's sort of this, you might be perceived as being a machine with parts, you know, you have this specific use and it restricts what the world and what you think you can
you're
do
telling
with your
me
life.
Brother, you're telling me. Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying not to. I'm just expressing what Belinda said. And then this idea that, you know, menopause sucks, but this life after pain where you're free, where you know, you're no longer this baby-making machine that you get to be this more complete.
You're suddenly, like,
you're
free
yourself.
Of the male gaze.
Yeah.
And so you can move through the world in a freer way, which is makes sense to me.
And then there's also this idea of, like, going out and flirting. Like, Fleabag's been in an interesting place. She's been off sex and all this sort of stuff for a while now. It was a destructive force for her in season one. But, you know, she's also early 30s or whatever she is.
Yeah.
Now is the time. Go out and flirt and do those things too. And like getting some perspective that like abstinence is not the answer either here. You've got to find the healthy middle ground somewhere in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Have fun, but have fun for the right reasons for you and
yes.
that it's actually fun. And yeah, you're not trying to prove anything to anyone or whatever it might be.
I just found this whole conversation just an interesting aside. Belinda is a character that's only in this episode. She's basically in that scene and is just sort of present in a couple of other scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just in almost an aside. It's not directly related to what's going on necessarily.
No, it's not.
It's just wanted to be included in there.
Yeah, I think it's just nice. You know, obviously season one was about love and grief, and this season's about love and faith. And like, while obviously we've got this big central thing of faith in, you know, an omnipotent being or whatever it might be, I like this faith of in yourself, faith in that things will get better, like a hope, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I thought it was a really lovely conversation. It's nice to see conversations between different generations of women.
Totally, yeah.
Which isn't something that we often get to see, which is good.
And just like, I'm trying to think of the only other woman that's really in this show that would be the same generation as Belinda is Godmother, and they're not having a conversation about that sort of stuff.
No. No honest conversations going on there, even when they do speak.
In general, there is less Godmother this season. Mm-hmm. Like, she is present, but she doesn't have that sort of overriding arching villain feel that she did in season one. That was season one again. And she, Olivia Colman, is left to just sort of have her moments and be as godmotherish as ever and be very good at it.
Yeah.
But she, yeah, she's not as involved in the story as she was in season one.
No, she's kind of more this season there for the jokes.
Yeah, she's more comic relief. Kind
of, you know, it works.
We also have, you said this was a season a lot about like family and stuff like this as well. In your
review. We certainly see quite a bit of her family,
including her dad. What did you make of what they did with him this season?
He was certainly softer and more accessible, still a distant father, but we were able to get those insights that we weren't allowed in season one. I think seeing that he does somewhat understand Fleabag, that he does see her, was interesting, because in season one, it certainly felt to me that he didn't. And that was his failing, is that he didn't do that. But in this, to the end of this season, we're like, oh, okay, he recognizes who she is.
Do you think we just, as an audience, come to a better understanding of who he is, I guess? That,
yeah, I think so.
Like, he talks about how he always loved his mother, or how he loves Fleabag, but he doesn't always like Fleabag. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, he didn't always like his wife.
Yeah.
Like, he was
very different people.
Very different. And he was quite jealous of her, he admitted. Jealous of her sort of being so kind and so...
always knowing what to do and...
fun and doing it so easily.
Yeah.
And even at her funeral, you know, he admits this sort of stuff, this moment of grief that it was... that relationship, he loved her, but it was hard for him at times to be with this woman who was so different. It's the mother figure still fascinates me so much.
I know, I want to know more.
And the funeral is such an interesting flashback. It's our first real extended flashback. There are no talk to camera sides in that at all. Mm. It is just a raw memory of that day and the absurdity of, like, looking amazing at your mother's funeral, which is a very funny little joke to run through that whole scene, I think. And then get a lot of time with Boo as well, and we see where Harry was at the time.
Harry.
And what Godmother was up to then. It's a really, really insightful scene into the backstories of these people. But again, we still feel like we're talking about the mother in the past tense.
Yeah, she's not, even in the flashbacks, the trauma of her death is still that big black hole.
Do you think that's what it is? It's like a wall that we're just not
talking
about that?
Definitely feels like it. But I just wanted to say that in season one, I posited, I'm like, oh, I wonder if Harry is always seems like he's on the verge of tears because of like the cheating and stuff. I was like, no. He was clearly always like that, even at her mum's funeral. He was telling her, and while crying, how hard it is when someone you know dies. So he's always just been a sloppy little shit. Mm.
I think we should maybe get towards the ending here. The moment at the end, well, we find out, I think a big revelation or a big moment here of symbolism here is that we find out that the sculpture that's been there since season one
is her mother.
Based on Fleabag's mother.
Banging bud.
Well, we're... knew she had Claire's... Oh, no, Claire had her boobs.
Yes.
That's right. The moment we find that out, she's just given the sculpture back to Godmother as sort of like a peace offering. It's like an olive branch.
But also like a fuck you.
And it's a fuck you.
I've had it, yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
But, you know, it can be both.
A fuck you, but it can be over. Yeah.
And then to find out that it was based on mother and then for her to have it at the end... I think that ultimate symbolism of where we leave Fleabag here, if this question was where does Fleabag put this, her love that she gave to Boo, that then Boo went, that she was considering giving to the priest, and she says she loves him and he loved her. She's still left holding on to this and not, we don't know where she's going to put it yet.
Yeah.
But she still waves goodbye to the camera. How do you feel about that moment, that little I'm leaving you goodbye moment?
Yeah, I guess I like what you're saying there about the statue kind of representing that love she has for her mother and her finally, like, I guess really possessing it herself.
Yeah.
And yes, she will give it to others, but at that moment she possesses it herself, which is really lovely.
Yep.
I also felt in those closing moments, you know, we talked about how her and the priest shared genuine intimacy, mm-hmm. and how that's why he could kind of see us or see that she was going somewhere else, because they shared true intimacy. And I liked the idea of, you know, when you experience the real thing, going back to false intimacy, you just can't do it anymore. And I think kind of that's what we were a little bit. Like when she's not really connecting with us, she wants to talk to someone real now. She really wants to connect with people, with someone, because she just had. So she's going to need to get over that. And there's hope now that she can do that and that she doesn't need us. So she gives us a little wave. Thanks for getting me through. But yeah, nah.
I don't need
you
anymore.
I want something. I know what I want now, and it's not this.
It's a really sad ending, but as you said, a really hopeful one at the same time. And yeah, the idea that, I mean, that's the other thing, that the priest, you know, going, where did you go? It does point out the fallacy of it, points out the artificiality of it. It's like, you're not, you weren't here, you were somewhere else.
Her inability to be present when she's faced with other people, she has to escape. Until she can't, when she's actually connected with someone.
What was the quote from Claire again? Happiness comes from confronting yourself for who you truly are. Maybe this is her chance to really be present, confront herself, and be happy eventually.
Yeah.
Any last words?
Final thoughts.
That's why you always leave a note.
Do you have any side notes to mask?
I've just got a bunch of quotes, really, that I very much enjoyed.
Love a good quote.
I love when she's in with the therapist and she just says, the therapist says to Fleabag, not a romantic, just a girl with no friends and an empty heart.
Yeah.
It's one of those lines that, it's quite a few of those in this show that make me laugh out loud, but also make me like go, oh, that hurts.
Yeah.
Like just breaks your heart. Next one is, Olivia Colman is so good. When the priest has told them that his brother is sick.
Yep.
And Fleabag goes, oh, here we go. And Olivia Colman just goes, you poor man. And the vitriol in the you is just perfection. It's it like chills up your spine when she says it. And then she just like so much sympathy then pours out of her. It's very well played.
Can I just jump on top of that one for a second?
Yes, of course.
When he leaves finally, and she, I think she calls him a cunt.
Yeah, a fucking cunt.
And then she's walking away and she just says to father, send them away. It's just like I can't do any justice, but the shrillness in that voice, just like send them away. It's just beautiful. Mm. Yeah, go on.
A heartbreaking line from Fleabag in the flashback to her mum's funeral. Just simply, I don't know where to put all the love I have for her.
It's
so, getcha. This is really the next one's really my favorite line. And I think it's also the wonderful performance by Claire and the wig work done, but simply when Fleabag turns up after her hysterical phone call from Claire and Claire turns around with that haircut and she goes, I look like a pencil. It just makes me laugh every single time. Very much appreciate that. Which then leads to my next favorite little diatribe when Fleabag goes into the hairdresser.
Yes.
And she goes, wow, hair is everything. We wish it wasn't so we could actually think about something else occasionally, but it is. It's the difference between a good day and a bad day. We're meant to think that it's a symbol of power, that it's a symbol of fertility. Some people are exploited for it and it pays your fucking bills. Hair is everything, Anthony. Which I just thought was beautiful. Beautifully written.
I also love how that scene ends. It's like this whole thing and then he shows the reference photo and it's like exactly what Claire wanted and just like, oh, sorry, Anthony, we'll leave. I'll see you next week.
Yeah.
And it's just like she's got, even though she's like, I can't believe we went back to Anthony. It's like she's got an appointment herself.
Yeah. And Anthony's response is perfect. He's like, if you want to change your life, change your life. It's not going to happen in here, which is perfect because every time something happens, every woman I know, but I'm sure lots of men do it as well, and non-binary folks, you go to the hairdresser and you just go for a change because you want to be a different person. So many people do it.
Just a moment as well that is in that scene between Claire and Fleabag in the park is the bit where they're talking about, you know, have you met a man or whatever? It's like, who is it? It's like, oh, he's a priest. And the look
I know
on Claire's face, just the head down in her hand.
And then she starts laughing. Just, it's so good.
Just the like even for you, this is just unbelievable.
Yeah,
it's
and I think she so turns to Fleabag and she's like, is it? And Fleabag's like, yeah. And she's like, fucking very well done.
So great. Anything else you want to say in site notes?
No, that's it for me.
I've got a couple. Mm-hmm. Just really wanted to mention these things. I thought they were worth bringing up. We do get a couple of scenes of the bank manager back in this.
Yeah, that was nice. Very important. Says goodbye.
Yeah, and very important in season one, obviously, really the bookends of this, of that story. And then is there and is just still supportive and involved in Fleabag's life and helps out for a bit. And then he's off to do his own thing. He's growing too. That's good. We do get to see Harry a couple of times in the flashback and in the present day. He's happily with another child. Woman and with child. So good on you, Harry. Good to see you doing well. I don't believe in God. And then the painting falls. The painting's falling and like being like God's presence in the church. It's very funny. And just the first time it happens and the way the hot priest just goes, I love it when he does that. It's really good. There's a couple little echoes of season one in here as well. When the priest asks her, would you like to volunteer? And she sort of jokes in the same or reacts in the same way she did to the whole being treated like a naughty bitch bit, where she gets excited about being asked. And then when he's like, I'm just joking, she's like, oh, that's disappointed. Interesting.
Did you see the hot priest's face when she was talking to Harry?
No.
He was not impressed.
Oh, really?
He was really, you could tell that he was really jealous.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting. I'll go back and watch it for a fourth time.
Viewing, yeah.
Why not? And then there's also the opening scene from the first episode of season one where she's standing at the door and she's like, do you know when
that's right, the callback.
The callback to that as well. So there's a couple little ones in there. There's a bit where Fleabag's talking to Godmother about how she texted Dad and just the way it's delivered. Yeah. Oh, I saw that. And you just, it says so much about her control of that man that she knows every single text message that comes through his
phone.
And
she's just like, oh, I have his phone today.
Okay. He has his phone. She has his phone today.
Yeah.
What the hell does that mean? I think the only other question I was going to ask, because I assumed you were going to love this season as much as I did, was, does this season have a flaw? Well, you didn't love it. So there you go. We'll move on from that one.
Brilliant.
Put my foot in it. Least favorite and favorite episode. Damask, what was your least favorite episode?
Well, my least favorite. But yeah, the show's so good. I don't really have any least favorite. So I just want to put that out there. But I'm going to go with episode 3.
Mm-hmm.
And I love when Claire and Fleabag are together.
Sure.
But the only reason I'm saying is because it just does have that level of disconnection, I guess, from the rest of the season. But that's it, really. It's not really a least favorite, but I had to give you one, so there you go.
Mine is episode 2, only because it's just getting the ball rolling. It's starting sentences, not finishing them, and the first step was so good. The second one is just sort of like, okay, now we're going to get this story rolling. That is literally it. I really like that episode, as I like every episode this season, so I don't know. That's to give you something. What's your favorite episode?
Episode 5, because we've got Claire's haircut, which is probably my favorite joke of the season, because I just very much enjoy that actress's face in that wig. It just gets me. It's also when Mutton comes over to the cafe and begs Fleabag not to let Claire leave him, and he's so desperate, and that scene is really tense between them. That just ends with like, fuck you, fuck you. It's great.
What's this line he says? It's like something about fucking a lawyer. It's like, I am fucking my lawyer. And he's like, lucky lawyer.
And you can see him look at like within himself being like,
damn,
I want to fuck her anyway. It's when the priest and Fleabag have sex, but it didn't feel like the creepy confessional scene, which I didn't like.
Oh, let's talk about that then.
Okay.
So creepy confessional scene. Why don't you like that? Is it just that whole like
they're in a confessional? It's like so fucked up, and he's like he's working as a priest in that situation.
Yep.
He comes around and tells her to kneel, which just makes me go fuck off.
Yes.
And just like, because that is so clearly wrong and crossing and mixing boundaries. That just makes me go gross, so gross. Whereas when he comes to her house, it's from like we have a real fucking intense emotional connection and I want this so badly, and she does as well. It feels much saner, more mutual kind of I can get my head around that one. That's fine. But the confessional one just creeped me the fuck out.
Do you think it's meant to creep you out, though? Do you think it's meant to come? Because I think there's an argument, and maybe some people, I'm not saying people feel this way. I don't feel this way. But I would not be surprised if people thought that was really hot, right?
People do think that's really hot.
Is that
scene
specifically?
That's the general consensus, is it, that it's really hot.
The whole Neil bit?
Yeah.
Because I think it's meant to be a little bit like, this is not right. Because he is in a terrible place.
Well, you can see
place.
That he's fucked up in that situation.
He is in a terrible... He's at his most vulnerable in that moment. He's drunk. He was found... He was not meant to be found by Fleabag at that point. Mm. She just happened to be... Or maybe she was doing it on purpose, but he did not intend to see her at that point. He was really, really in inner turmoil.
Mm.
And all of that is just like him making bad decision after bad decision. I think it's meant to feel icky. Even if it's meant to feel kind of darkly sexy or something, it should feel a bit icky too. And I think that's the right vibe. I think that's the right feeling.
That's good to know.
Personally. Because it really is. If his story is like his fall and then return to God, like this is like the lowest. He is like, it's like desecrating a holy place.
Yeah.
What he's doing. It is not a cool thing if God is ultimately his true love and what he's going to return to.
Mm.
I find the whole thing very compelling.
It's like fucking your mistress in your marriage, babe.
Yeah. It's complex, as gross as it is, and definitely understand where you're coming from, your perspective on it. But that's why I kind of find it so compelling. I like it a lot, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
That's fair. I do want to say that the cafe scene in episode 4 is probably my favorite scene, but episode 5 is my favorite.
Interesting. Gotcha.
Yeah. So that, to clarify, the scene when the priest sees us.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is excellent. Like a standout.
It's great. It's a great
use
scene.
Of your format to just like break your
audience.
It was
shocking when you see it.
Second.
It was exciting.
Yeah.
It like changed the game. Like, what the fuck is going on? Yeah, it was good.
Cool. My favorite episode was episode 1, which is the restaurant episode,
very
basically.
Good episode.
It's the one that won for best writing for Fleabag, and in season 2 in the Emmys, I should say, and I can see why. I think it's just a freaking great episode. I think it's as good, if not better, than any episode in season 1, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It's really funny. There's like even just one of the early moments with the dad where he's like trying to give his toast.
Oh,
he just can't.
Just waffling and nothing is coming out.
Gets to that point where I just want to say, And just like, it's such like a perfect definition of him.
Mm-hmm.
And then the overhelpful waitress is just a funny little detail in it as well. It hooks me in quickly. I'm feeling the energy between Fleabag and Hot Priest at this point pretty quickly. There's a lot of tension with Martin, the miscarriage stuff, all the, just the frustration with Claire and what the fuck is she doing?
Mm.
It's really, really exciting and tense in there. And then the satisfying moment where they're in the cab at the end and... You know, she says to go to the hospital and Claire looks at her but sort of says thank you and they're back quickly.
Yeah. The real bonding moment is when, I can't remember which one says it, but one of them's like, oh, the priest is pretty hot.
Yes.
And the other one's like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you just know that like they're just back to being sisters again.
Yeah.
And I love it. It's such a satisfying, brilliant
episode. It's a good episode. Yeah.
Yeah. Love it. Predictions, hopes, or concerns? This might seem out of place because it doesn't seem like we're going to get any more.
I reckon we'll get a third season in a while.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That was the question I was going to ask. Do you think we will? Do you think we should?
I don't see any reason why we shouldn't. With enough time passed, I think that's fine. You know, she goes through another trauma, whatever it might be. She's in a different place. And we, her kind of dissociative buddies, you know, drop by and check up on her because she... Well, that's the thing. Is like she only needs us when she's in turmoil. So if something else happens in her life that gets her spinning out of control, we'll probably pop up again.
I have a theory on what it might look like. Because I'm a big believer that if there's anything more to be talked about, it really has to be Fleabag's relationship with her mother.
Yes.
It's like, it's just that one aspect that it's so important to understand.
Do you reckon it's when she has kids?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Which maybe seems too obvious. And the last thing I want to do is peg this as like, oh, the defining story of her life is going to be her child. Like, I don't think that's what needs to happen. But it just opens up a conversation between her and her mother if then she's in a motherly role to a young daughter or something like that, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And I did want to just quote a little bit of an interview here. This comes from the article, Fleabag Season 3, Maybe When She's 50, says Phoebe Waller-Bridge. This comes via Nick Romano at Entertainment Weekly. I'll put a link in the show notes for the episode. This is the quote. I quite like the idea of coming back to her, well, me, when I'm 50, because I feel like she would have had more life then. And God knows what she would have got up to. She told Seth Meyers during an appearance on Late Night, actually, seeing a character like her in that later stage of her life is exciting, but for now, she's been through enough. We've got to let her go. I quickly, very quickly, if you will indulge me, wanted to talk about seeing the recording of the live stage show, the original one woman play.
Yes.
And just how it was very similar and only and somewhat different. And I think what I really want to talk about is the art of adaptation. Because I think that's what I came away most fascinated by. It is extremely similar to the series. It's basically season one. It's basically episode one. And then they've sort of spread the rest of the story. Because I think it sort of takes place of like 2 or 3 days, basically, in the stage show. And then they've sort of...
Is it a one-woman show?
It is. It's one woman with a couple of voiceovers.
Gotcha.
Right? So she will... is talking to the audience and she was like, she'll recreate moments. So she'll be herself and then she'll do a little bit of Claire, who I think is called Lily in the play. And she'll do her dad, who's barely in it. Godmother is only mentioned. She's never present. She's not a character at all in it. She plays Bus Rodent, who's Tube Rodent. She plays Harry. She plays Asshole Guy. And like a lot of those characters are there. But really, it's mostly episode one and then... The actual start of the stage show is the interview with the bank manager in the bank. And it ends not with him coming to the cafe, but with we return to that interview after the bit where they do the whole bit of like perv, slut, wow. We go back and they have actually continued. They've had their little moment talking about their own mistakes. And then they continue and they go, let's try this again. That's the bookend of the play, but it's actually a return back to the start, right?
So does that mean they don't have the moment when Claire and Fleabag go to the getaway and she hangs out with the bank manager? Yeah.
We see Claire twice.
Right.
The first time is at the feminist lecture, which is very similar. And the second time is when she hasn't heard from Claire for a couple of days. Claire said she's going to give her the money for the cafe and that she's going to leave Martin. And then she goes over there. I haven't heard from you. Are you going to give me the money or not, basically? And she goes, does the whole, how could I? Because at the lecture, Claire's talking about Martin and Fleabag goes, your husband tried to fill me up at Christmas. So what the show did is it made that part of the story as was happening.
Gotcha.
But it was actually an initial event. She reveals that. Claire says, I'm going to leave Martin. Then when she confronts Claire later, she's like, how could I leave you? How could I? Believe you after what you did to Boo, and then she spirals. There's another character in the play called Joe, who's sort of this really happy-go-lucky guy who, in a really, really low moment after that, she's looking for that connection she gets from having sex, tries to have it on with him, and he sort of walks away. And the other big thing that changes is, you remember in the first season where Bus Rodent goes to kick Hillary?
Yeah.
He really does. Twice, and it was shocking because I wasn't expecting it because it didn't happen in the play in the show. And then I won't spoil this moment. Some other stuff happens that's really dark and not at all in the TV show.
Okay,
because people will be able to go and find this. But there's a couple of extra little dark moments. One other thing I will quickly mention: one of the things I liked about this, apart from seeing like this art of adaptation, which is really phenomenally done, is such a great like expansion on this story and a great adaptation. Things are mixed around and sort of moved to different places and stuff. Claire is expanded upon in a big way, Godmother and Dad and stuff, obviously. But it's what you sort of get to see almost like outtakes. So some moments that we have seen word for word go one or two lines further, which is interesting. And probably the most insightful moment was when she's talking about what happened with Boo's boyfriend. And she simply says, in a way, I think of her trying shift the blame, says, it wasn't my fault. He wanted me.
Mm.
Which completely fits with what we know.
Yeah.
But like in terms of her explanation of what happened there, this addiction she has to that feeling, that need to be wanted, is not something that's ever said. It's certainly alluded to, but hearing it come from her mouth was just a little extra detail that was interesting to hear. Anyway, I've indulged. You've indulged me. Thank you for that.
Yeah, no, that was interesting. Thank you. I've always been fascinated about what it looks like, so thank you for that.
I would highly recommend it. I don't think it replaces it at all. It's so similar.
Mm.
It's like as to be like it can't replace it in your mind. You've watched it 3 times. I think you'd only find it interesting in terms of like how this would be presented as a stage show first and then adapted TV show. They are the same thing, but completely different in their mediums and yet identical in their core structure. Yep. Fascinating stuff.
Gotcha.
Anyway, that's it. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Hunting Seasons. You can find more of what we do via our website, huntingseasonspodcast.com. Our logo and design work comes from Sean Kirkpatrick, aka at ShawneeBoyDraws, and our theme song and bumpers from Lucas Heil of Birthday Loyalty Club. Find links to their work in our show notes. You can also find myself, Broderick Gordis, on Twitter at BGordis, B-G-O-R-D-E-S, Damask.
You can find me on Twitter at Maskymoo, M-A-S-K-Y-M-O-O.
Next week, we'll be back with a new review episode to discuss BoJack Horseman Season 6, Part 1.
Yes.
So Part 1, for those who don't know, Season 6 is the final season of BoJack Horseman. It's been split in two. Mm-hmm. The first part, we don't know if it's a half or more than, is coming out at the next week, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then Part 2 of that will be out at the end of January. So we're going to talk about Part 1. We've done that a couple of times. We did that with Star Trek Discovery. We've done that with Breaking Bad in its final season. And you know what?
Mm.
This actually is only fair. We did stick Season 1 and 2 of BoJack Horseman together into one episode. So now it's going to get...
Oh, yeah.
Now it's going to have the proper amount of episodes dedicated to
it.
Are you excited for that, Damask? Are you excited for BoJack?
Yeah, I'm very much excited. That's one of my favorite shows. Maybe ever. Yeah, I'm very excited.
Me too. In the meantime, thank you again for listening. We will see you next time. Bye for now.
Bye.
Good night, everybody.
And so, completely.